just restart.
Okay.
And so this is Laura Murray and Pete Tenorowitz again. And let's see, you were talking about working at the newspaper, and before that you were just talking about this band. So can you tell me, what was your band? Was it the best band or the second best band or the third best band?
I think our band started as the third best, and then we worked our way up to the top band.
And what was the makeup of these bands? So you have the drummer?
We had drums, keyboard, which at that time would have been an electronic accordion or a portable keyboard, guitar, and saxophone. That's what our band had. And two of the guys sang. So we could play a variety of music with those instruments. We could really do a lot. There were other kid rock bands, but you know they could only play a few different kinds of jobs. And then there were like the oldsters that just had the piano and sax and trumpet and trombone. And so we were kind of in the middle. We could play some disco tunes, some Elvis things, plus some swing tunes and some ethnic stuff and some Latin things if we needed to, because you know people were also taking lessons in ballroom dancing, and you know that was a time when music had everything from like Tony Orlando and Dawn to Cher to you know Elvis, and there was a wide variety, so we ended up covering a lot of material. Plus I just think everybody in the band was younger, and we kind of put out some energy, and you know, just those things don't change. But there were some older folks in town playing, and I think we just were somebody, something different. So it worked good. Everybody lived around town. We got along well, as the band stayed together for a long time.
What was its name?
The Classics. Then we added a new guy. We called ourselves the New Classics. Yeah, so.
Do you still play music?
Yes, I do. We all wore matching shirts and that kind of thing, you know, back then. Yeah, I do, except this job I have now is a really different work schedule. I go away for a couple of days at a time, and it's hard for me to tell somebody, yeah, I can be somewhere to play a gig at a certain time. But I have a few people that I play on and off with. I'm also very involved in hand drumming, African drumming, and group hand drumming. So we have a group locally that does that and does drum instruction. But you know, knowing that, you know, before I took this job, I obviously knew that. So the last band I was in, which was called the Overtones, which was three school teachers plus me, kind of reached a point where two of those guys retired, and one moved down south, and one of the other fellows wanted to be less involved. So at that time, I decided to, take a temporary retirement myself from the music business, because it's a commitment, you know, if you're in that kind of business, it's 48 weekends a year, and that's what I did for many years. You know, it's more of a part-time job than anything. And now looking at the music business as what it's become, not only in Hudson, but in general, it's a lot different. It's a lot different. It seems like a lot of different styles of music. It depends on who you are as a person, who you know. They want people in the band that they like to hang out with. The music's not very complicated, so if they know a cool guy, you know, that plays bass, and they don't really need a bass, well, we'll just have them play guitar or drums, because probably in a month or two, we could probably learn what he has to know on that instrument, so that'll be good enough. You know, they're not really looking for somebody that plays a lot of styles and can read music or anything like that, because they might be playing in a folk genre that's kind of specific, or just some blues, and that's all they're going to play. So it maybe doesn't require the you know, the background of people that we needed back when we were doing this more or less as a business. Although I've been on a few cruises and different places where they've got terrific musicians, young music school graduates that really can play anything. So it's good to. It's good to see. You know, my youngest son's a music school graduate, and he's struggling because everybody's a music school graduate these days, you know. And so he works other jobs besides playing music.
Is he a drummer, too?
No, he's a guitar player.
He didn't follow in the family tradition?
No, but also plays trumpet. So he got some jobs because he could play. You know, they needed a guitar player, but he could double on trumpet for, say, two tunes that they wanted a trumpet on, so they got him, you know. He can also play a little keyboard. He played with one of the contestants that was on The Voice. He did a tour with that woman. His name I can't remember right now. But what happens is they hire you for a specific couple of jobs or maybe a couple of months, and then that's over, and then the artist decides to do something else and hire another group of musicians for another project, you know, or joins another artist for another project. It's not, you know, it's not a great employment scene.
Now, you were all union members back at that time. When did the union lose its hold?
I'd say by the end of the 80s, you had to then, you know, we had our own Hudson Local. We paid dues. We had to file our contracts with the union local to make sure we weren't undercutting, you know, price. We had a minimum price we had to charge. At some point, I think the union officers were retiring and unable to carry on, so we had to join either the Albany or the Poughkeepsie local. They were much more expensive to join. There were a lot more requirements, and I think a lot of local musicians just said, the market's good, we'll market ourselves, we don't have to worry about that anymore. And that's kind of what's happened all over the country. The Musicians Union now is very involved in recording, or these contracts with Carnival Cruise Lines, or these casino companies, or something like that. But they used to be very involved on a local level. And it was also a way to get work and to be, you know, involved with other musicians. So that's kind of all gone by the wayside. I'm sure it's been replaced by Facebook and social media and the internet and all that other, you know, the market's been all fractured like it has been for a lot of other arts over the years.
So you were working as a musician in high school and so on, and how did you get to working at the prison?
Well, I think after I got married, we wanted to buy a home, and a lot of jobs didn't pay that much. The newspaper, while it was a fun place to work, was owned by one man. He paid a few key people what he had to pay them, and all the other jobs were just a rotation of college and high school kids. And this is also a time that newspapers were being bought out by newspaper chains, and so were a lot of other businesses in town. The local furniture guy would sell out to some regional furniture chain, or, you know, things like that. Plus, I just think it was a sense of adventure. You know, I knew a few guys that had become cops. Actually, the job I was kind of interested in was state park ranger from sailing. You know, I knew that was a good job. So I took a state battery of tests, and I think the first one I called was corrections. And at that time, you know, they were looking to fill vacancies. They upped the salary and benefits and pension package to attract people. So myself and a few people I knew said, well, let's take this job and, you know, we'll stay in it for a couple of years and see what happens. And of course, as you may be aware, a lot of people do that, and then 25 years later, they're still in the same job. So I did that, and I started off working in some larger prisons outside the area, because that was where the needs for the employees were. And then I made my way back, you know, to the Hudson prison. So for many years, I enjoyed a good, stable civil service job that had superior benefits and pay, and it seemed to suit me. You know, it was good to have that security when you're raising a family and not have to think that in a few more years another project or another company is going to come along and you have to scramble for something. So it was good for me. You know, it's not for everybody, but it was good for me. I'm an organized person. I think I have a rounded life, so that I don't think I got too involved in that authoritarian part of the job, you know, too much. So it just worked out well for me now in retrospect. You know, there are a lot of days I'm like figuring, what am I doing here? But that was also a time, the 80s and 90s, the economy wasn't doing great. I know you hear about that a lot now in the U.S., but there were other times. 70s, the economy wasn't great. Then we went through the whole globalization thing where a lot of employers in town, you know, moved away. They were bought by bigger companies. Next thing you know, the job is going to Mexico or China or Malaysia or something like that. And I was kind of able to escape that by working in the prison system.
What jobs did you do there?
Well, as a correction officer, obviously uniform, you know, security for overall security with inmates, supervision of inmates. But at some point, you know, I got involved in this labor management committee that ran an employee assistance program. So what that was if we had an employee with a personal problem, a drug or alcohol problem, some kind of mental health problem, they could be referred to the employee assistance program, who would then refer the employee for assistance, and was overseen by both management and labor. So I was the facility coordinator for that position. Every New York State correctional facility has an employee assistance program coordinator. Well, as do many of the state offices and campuses also. It's a peer support and referral service. I did have to have a lot of training, but obviously I'm not educated formally in that. So that was part of my duties. You know, it was a uniform job, and I did corrections, but, you know, for a day or two a week, I would also do this extra job of EAP coordinator. So I found it interesting. Also found it very stressful to work with problem employees. In many ways, much easier to work with inmates who know what their role is and there's rules and procedures to deal with them. In dealing with problem employees, it's always very gray. A lot of employees are not always going to look at their job as a career. They're not always going to seek a solution to problems. So it was definitely an education for me.
I guess you've talked about that work in that other oral history project a bit.
Yes, I did. And I'm sure people are tired of hearing it.
Well, I doubt it. I actually come from a city with a lot of prisons, and a lot of them. And I guess one of the questions that occurs to me is, what would you say is the place of the correctional facility in Hudson? Like, how much do most people think about it? What kind of percentage of the workforce is it? Or, you know, is it present in the sense that there is a high percentage of the population incarcerated in it? How big a presence is it?
Well, when I was growing up, it was the girls' training school. We just called it the girls' school or the training school. It's run by the state and started years ago as a women's house of refuge. A lot of people in town work there. A lot of the black population, the African Americans, male and female, both worked at the prison. It's sort of off the beaten path. You know, you have to kind of drive down the gully behind St. Mary's Church, and then it kind of sits up on a plateau surrounded by trees. So, you know, to the casual visitor to Hudson, you wouldn't even know it was there, but it's actually been there since, I think, 1890-something. And some of the buildings, like the chapel, are original buildings to that. So there's always been some sort of a correctional facility there with employees from the town. I even had inmates who had parents or grandparents that were employees there. And they were actually now incarcerated in the facility, where as a child they would drop their mom or their aunt off to work when they lived in a, you know, in a drivable air, you know, distance from the prison. So they would talk about that, you know. And I think certainly at the time that I went to work there, it was considered a good job. Wow, you were pretty lucky you got in there. Wow, that's good for you, you know. It was a medium security prison. Because of the architecture of the prison being what they call the cottage system. It kind of made for an easygoing atmosphere. A lot of the inmates worked in work gangs in the community. They worked at the firehouses, the city buildings, the churches. They unloaded the food pantry truck. You know, when I say they worked in these buildings, I mean they painted, they stripped the floors, they fixed the windows. They got to know the townspeople. In a way, it was a little bit of a positive experience for both the townspeople and the inmates, too. So to see prison vans driving around town or the inmates out mowing the lawn in the cemetery is not unusual. I don't think anybody looked at the prison as a nefarious place or where there was some sort of mass incarceration going on. I don't think anybody thought that at all. I think if they knew of a local inmate that was in the prison, they certainly knew the inmate's background and his criminal history just from living in town and reading the newspaper. And I don't think anyone back then thought there was anything other than this guy earned his way into the jail. But we know him and his kid's in my class, and when he gets out, hopefully he'll... I mean, I used to see inmates at the local Little League field, and I won't say they high-fived me, but they were almost like, hey, Mr. T, how are you? How's it going? And, you know, it wasn't some sort of we weren't like enemies or anything, you know? But again, that's part of the small town thing. People aren't anonymous. Although in later years, I would go to the malls in Albany, and sometimes those guys sweeping the floor were recent parolees that I knew, and we spoke to each other. I probably wouldn't give them the keys to my car, but you know, I don't think there was anything evil going on. You know? Yeah, I used to see them all the time. So,
is this your neighbor's car alarm? We'll just wait it out for a sec. There we go.
Okay. All right, good. Yeah, so it was a presence in the community. Yeah, I don't think anybody in later years, you know, as generations changed, there probably came a time, certainly my kids wouldn't say, hey, I think I'll follow my father's footsteps and become a prison guard. I don't think they were critical of it because they knew me and other prison guards just from the community. But there came a time when I think they wanted to do more, whether it was they want to do something more exciting or more rewarding or something more interesting, I'm sure. You know, those of us that worked at the prison, we knew we were there for our 8 hours, and then our lives resumed again after work, you know. And it was a good job. It provided you to live, have other things in your life, you know. And so if you're a person who feels that they have to get all that from their job, well, then that's probably not the job for you. It seems like a lot of younger people today do want the job that's not only fulfilling, it's got to be creative, and it has to have some cachet attached to it, and it has to be a lot, you know. Like my thing I always tell people is it's okay to be ordinary. You know, it's okay to be the assistant manager at the drugstore. There's nothing wrong with it. But that's a horror show to a lot of young people today, especially a lot of very educated young people. When I meet people in town through my drumming or even at the coffee shop or something, you know, they start complaining about the rent and the cost of living, and I suggest some jobs. When they say, well, what do you do? I say, well, I work at the railroad. Well, that's a great job. How do I get in there? Well, you got to take a test. You have to go to Atlanta for training, and then you start off, and then, whoa, I don't want to do all that. Or they'll say to me, did you go to the club, you know, to see this band last night at Club Helsinki? And I'll say, you know, I didn't, because that's the day, you know, I have to get called for work at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I make sure I'm home in bed by 8:30. Well, that's a job they can't consider. So right away, they don't consider it. Or I'll say, you know, Susie works at the hospital. There's a lot of good jobs at the hospital. What does she do? She's a nurse. What hours does she work? 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Well, I can't do that because I'm going to miss these very important social activities. And when you see the young people at work, they're looking at these things in real time on their phone. Look what I'm missing, you know? So this becomes a larger-than-life thing, you know? So this idea that you have a job that maybe involves some sacrifices and then you use that to attain something else seems to me like lost on some people. I don't know. I hope I'm not being too critical. I've had that discussion a little bit with my kids as well. You know, there has to be some kind of balance. It seems like that was just a given back in the day, and now everybody's looking for, you know, a lot more out of their workaday life. I could be wrong about that, but I see a lot of examples of that now with people.
Did you generally feel it was a job you could leave behind at the end of the day? You didn't have trouble forgetting about it and switching gears?
I did, because the two previous jobs I had, both at the newspaper and I worked at a car dealership too, those employers told you were on the job 24 hours a day. And they thought nothing of calling you at home, telling you to stay late, to come in Saturday morning, and you weren't paid extra. That was just part of your career. But after a while, it seems like only the owner of the business was benefiting by that. It seemed like my job at the correctional facility, once I punched the clock, that was it. They didn't want you there after that, you know. They just wanted you to do what you were supposed to do. So it was easy to leave the prison at 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. and then go and do something with the sailboat or do something with music or do something with the children or come home and work on your house, you know. Or, you know, and if you had something to do, on fix something on your house, chances are there was another guy from the prison that you knew that would meet you afterwards and you'd work on it. You know, and then the next week you'd go and help him on his house. So we had this little community of guys, you know, at work. But we knew we could do that because we knew what our set hours were, you know. So it did seem like it was good for somebody who didn't have to get a lot of their self-identity out of that job, you know.
And that was unionized work too?
Yes, it was, and still is. Yeah.
And are you working, your current job, is that a union job as well?
Yes, it is.
So how do you think about unions and their role in your working life?
Well, for me, they've been very important. Three jobs that I had over the years, musician, Department of Corrections, and the railroad that were unionized, I feel I've benefited a lot from those jobs. The two jobs I had that were non-union, it seemed like I had to give more of myself, and the employer got more out of it. I know that that's just anecdotal, but that's kind of been demonstrated to me a little bit. I'm really sorry to see a decline in unionization.
So I think you're going to have to explain to me, because we don't have that much more time, but you're going to have to explain to me how you retired and got a job on the railroad. That sounds like a paradox.
Sure. My brother's an airline pilot. When we were kids, we had model train layout, and we both loved railroads, watching the train go by, and we thought that would be a great job to have. When I was young, I did look into it, but at that time, the railroads were contracting. They were breaking all their old agreements. They were overloaded with employees, so they weren't hiring anybody. So I kind of went on to what I went on to. And years later, I started reading that, you know, the railroads were undergoing a renaissance, and they were looking to hire people. I went to a hiring session for the railroad to see what jobs were available. And at age 50, I said, would you still hire people? And they said, absolutely. You know, they have a real no age discrimination. If you're physically able to do the job, we're going to hire you. And I thought about retiring from corrections, because you can retire and collect your pension after 25 years. There's no age requirement. And by going to work for the railroad, which is a private industry, I could still collect my pension, you know, work for the railroad, save up a nest egg that was hard to save, raising three kids and sending them to school and all that, those things that go on. So I took a real deep breath. I had a lot of sleepless nights, and I said, I'm going to do this. It's kind of hard for me, because I'm not a person that makes a lot of changes. I told you earlier, lived in the same house for like 32 years, been married for 34 years. Previous job I had was for 27 years. even all the times I played in bands, I really only played in like 3 bands in 35 years. So I'm not a big changer of things, okay? And obviously a person who enjoys being a civil servant is not a risk taker type of personality. You need security. So at age 50, I retired from the prison. I went to work for CSX Railroad as a freight train conductor. I went to Atlanta for 6 weeks for training. I had a bunch of months of on-the-job training after that. I experienced a lot of new things, working with new people or out of my comfort level. I was able to do it, so I really got a lot of satisfaction out of that, you know. But it's been a lot of hours. The company really, you really are a number to the company. As a matter of fact, when you call them, you have to give them your number. You don't give them your name. And, you know, everything is high-tech that way. So it's really been, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of work, you know. But I feel like it was a good accomplishment at that time of my life to be able to do it also. So now I'm the guy that's waving at people out of the train. You know, and I always tell my engineers when they're complaining about the job, I said, see that guy in that car waiting at that grade crossing? He's got a job at like, he's like the food manager at Walmart. And Sally just called in sick and somebody else is going on vacation. And he's mulling that through his mind. And he sees us going by on the train. He's saying to himself, those lucky son of a bitches, all I have to do is ride on a train all day. I want one of those jobs, all right? So don't complain about it.
So you get to live your childhood fantasy.
Sort of, yes, yes.
Just tell me about a day in the life of a train conductor. Really, I have no idea, okay? Like, what routes are you going? What do you do?
Okay. I go on the line that goes from Albany to Boston. It's a very scenic line. So I get a 2-hour call before I go to work. So let's say, like I said before, I get called at 3 o'clock in the morning to be on duty at 5 o'clock. Hours of service, I can only be on duty for 12 hours. So I've already got my clothes ready and my lunch packed. I know on a window they're going to call me between 3 a.m. and 10 a.m. So I get to the railroad yard. There's a bunch of paperwork, a train manifest, and safety bulletins that have to be printed out of a computer. I've got to fax some things to some people. I call my boss on a telephone. The people that call me to go to work are in Jacksonville, Florida. I call my boss on a telephone that's in another building somewhere to say I'm there. When the train comes in the yard, another guy calls me and says, we're going to send you a ride. So we get a van service to take us to the track where our train is. We inspect the engines. We talk to the dispatcher, who's in some other place on the radio. And we get our signals, and we start going on the train. So I keep track of the hazmat stuff that's on the train. If we stop along the way, I have to get out of the train and by radio tell the guy to move the engine, move the train. I've got to switch some switches, make couplings, hook the air hoses. Something goes wrong with the train, I got to get out and walk it and try to fix it. We do brake inspections on cars that we pick up along the way, something like that. Is there downtime? Yeah. A lot of times you get paid to do something when something goes wrong, like a lot of jobs. When I get to the other end, we've got to spot the cars and sidings, you know, for the, if it's an intermodal train, they've got these big cranes that unload the containers and the truck trailers. If it's a freight train, I've got to put it in another yard for another railroad to take, or turn the train over to another railroad to take on to like Portland, Maine, or Providence, Rhode Island, or something like that. When we get done with our engines, we got to bring those to the engine terminal and tie them down. Another van comes and gets us. They take us to the hotel, where we have to have a mandatory rest period of 12 hours also, and then we're in line to get called for another train. That may or may not happen soon. I'm frequently in the hotel for 24 hours, and then we get called to come back. So 2-hour call. The van comes and gets you. Sometimes we have to get our engines in one place, you know, and maybe go to another terminal and then put together a few tracks of trains, you know, get them all coupled together on different sidings. When that gets all done, then they drive me to the engine, you know, in a vehicle, and then we take our train to the next city where we may or may not have to stop and add or subtract cars or something like that. Some railroaders just work in the yard, so they're just working in a railroad yard on a shift basis, you know. Some railroaders work on a local train that they take and distribute cars to industries. You know, I'm line of road, so I'm taking the train pretty much 150 to 170 miles every time. Average day for me is 10 or 11 hours on duty. But, you know, like if it's a snowstorm, you can get caught out there. Like we've stalled the train on a mountain in a snowstorm. We have to wait for another train to come by and pick us up to take us to the terminal. So you could be out there for like 16 or 17 hours, something like that. You know, you got to get out sometimes if the weather's not good and fix things that go wrong. Like a switch could get iced in, or some kind of big rainstorm could cause a tree limb to fall down and short out signals. So we have to, you know, once you leave the terminal on that train, kind of you're kind of it, you know. So there's a lot to do, but there's also downtime too, and it's time to look at the scenery and, you know, take in the railroad atmosphere. It's a big safety culture. It's a big job where you have to do everything according to a certain safety rule and a certain procedure, a lot of consistency, you know, a lot of big equipment moving around. So, you know, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of being very careful about how you do things. Not a lot of personal interpretation. You know, there's books of rules that could lead to the ceiling, and it's your job to know those or at least interpret them, you know. And, of course, we're always debating, well, does that rule mean this or that, you know. So that, in that way, that was a lot like corrections, you know, all these piles of directives and, you know, rules that have to be adhered to, that kind of thing.
So how many people are working on a given freight train?
Just myself, the conductor, and the engineer. It's a two-man crew. It's been that way for about 20 years.
So that is a lot of responsibility.
Yep, it's just two of us. And we both ride up in the engine.
Things, you're getting, I guess, a fair amount of computerization in terms of signals and messages and stuff, but ultimately you're the guy who has to still get out, fix that switch or whatever.
Right. There is a lot of high tech, but there's also a lot of real primitive things that are done, you know, just like they were done 100 years ago. The brakes on the freight cars are like Fred Flintstone brakes. The couplers and air hoses haven't changed in 100 years. Our tools on the train are like a giant engineering hammer, a chisel, and like this wrench that's like some primitive-looking wrench. And they still use those things today. Yeah, it's pretty unique. Yeah, very unique.
It must be interesting to just think of all the railway workers who have gone along those tracks for so long.
It's a lot of history, a lot of old buildings. You know, just the names they have for the places and the tracks go back so many years. You know, they call tracks like the Third Iron or the Fourth Iron. You know, they'll call a track the Barn Track, because up until 1940, there was a barn right next to that track. So generations later, they're still calling it the Barn Track, you know. That, yeah, to somebody like me, that really makes you think of history and, yeah, the role the railroads have played, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of the younger people, that's just lost on them, you know. They just don't even think about that, you know. And to them, it's just a job, which is probably the way the company wants it. But, you know, it's very interesting to me to see remnants of old railroad buildings and property and then do a little research to see how it was, you know, before World War II and see what went on, what that meant to the country. So many of these cities in the Northeast were just full of huge mills and factories, and the tracks just ran through them like a canyon, you know. And you think about the thousands of people that had skilled jobs that worked in those factories, you know, largely walking to work, and you know, all replaced by technology, you know, not all of it man-made. I mean, one of our factories here in Hudson was the match factory that made matches. Well, we don't have a lot of people smoking today. And if we have to light our barbecue grill, we use this little butane thing. So, you know, times change. So those jobs didn't go to China. They just disappeared.
I was told there was a button factory here as well.
Yeah, that was a more recent thing. Yeah, there was a big button. One of the biggest button factories in the country was here. Made buttons out of resins and plastics and metal.
But that buttons did go overseas. Buttons are more often ornamental now than mandatory that we wear T-shirts.
Oh, yeah, right. That's right, yeah. I don't button much up anymore.
So I'm just wondering if there's anything else you'd like to talk about, people you'd like to mention from your family or your life here, or people you think we might talk with as we proceed with the project?
Hmm. I could probably think of somebody, but I don't know. So much is changing now in town, you know. And the town is right at the tipping point of the old natives who still retain some political power. It's going to tip very shortly the other way. So the new idealists are going to have to take over. But now they're going to have to do the things that they don't want to think are done, like keep the sewer clean and the water pipe going. And, you know, so that'll be interesting to see how that goes. Now, I'm actually in the town of Greenport. If you cross the street down here, you're in the city of Hudson. A lot of people think this is Hudson, but this is actually the town of Greenport. So the town of Greenport is kind of the default place where development happens, and they put up the Walmart and the warehouse and stuff like that. You know, the big debate going on in Hudson is, should we allow this change to this building? Does it look good? You know, that's something that's not even, which I think is fine, but it's not something we're even involved here in Greenport. I'm kind of on the committee to update the town of Greenport's comprehensive plan. We don't even talk about those things, you know. It's not in anybody's mind. We're still talking about where should we have development and where shouldn't we, you know. Because out in the county, because of so many newcomers, they don't want development in their towns. They don't want the traffic. They don't want to see a light or hear anything. So everything is coming now to Greenport, you know. And it's nice for our tax base. But because of the tax formula, we don't receive all the revenues. They're divided up into the county based on population of the towns. So that's another thing we're trying to talk about. Unfortunately for Hudson, they don't have any more land to use. So everything, you know, is just in that little 2 square mile area. So I think that ignites a lot more debate and a lot more, you know, it's just fewer resources now, fewer buildings, and who's going to buy them, and what are they going to do? And they're already feeling the squeeze with rents and things like that, you know. So in a way, we can kind of be observers and don't really have to take it too much to heart, you know. But it's going to be up to the people of Hudson to go to those common council meetings and committee meetings, and you know, that's a little different from just getting on Facebook and saying something. You know, once you're the one answering the phone from people wanting to know why this or that doesn't work. So I hope they're up for it. We'll see. Yeah, there's probably a billion people you should be talking to.
Well, you can always let Suzanne and others know later. But it's an interesting point you mentioned to me that so you, as the sort of outlying area here in Greenport, you're also affected by these changes in Hudson, and that people in Hudson may not want a Walmart in Hudson, but they still want a Walmart. They still want to be able to go somewhere to buy, you know, I don't know, swimming pool noodles or whatever they happen to need, right? So that puts pressure on you to decide how much of that kind of development you want, and it will change your town as well.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Right now, because Greenport has good infrastructure, water and sewer and electric handy and things like that, there's more lower income apartment buildings being proposed, because what previously might be a 4 or 6 unit apartment building in Hudson is now going to be a 1 or 2 unit weekender house, gutted and not available for rental. So we've already seen now over the last few years, people that can't afford an apartment in Hudson, they're going to have to rent in a big multi-apartment building in Greenport. And then that is a place where we have to provide fire protection, police services, sewer, water, plow the road, all that kind of thing, you know. So that's something we have to consider now for Greenport.
So the low-income people are being displaced from Hudson?
I think so. We call it subsidized housing. A lot of it's because they're elderly. Some of it's because they're unable to work or otherwise subsidized. Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people that are buying property in Hudson are doing it for their convenience, certainly. A weekend place from New York. There may be some, you know, the old apartment building owners that were always referred to as slumlords, they're kind of slowly being replaced. They're aging out. Yeah, there's several new apartment complexes underway right now in Greenport. And they're partly subsidized housing and partly senior housing. Absolutely, yeah. I think that's a big effect of Hudson, of what's going on in Hudson, you know. I mean, that's great for what's going on in Hudson. I mean, it's really good. But what do you do? You know, if somebody has a job that's in food service at the hospital and they're making not much more than minimum wage, how are they going to pay $1,200 rent and then some? You know, so.
Do you think your grandmother would recognize the place?
Yes. Oh, yeah, a lot of the buildings hasn't changed. And some of that's because, you know, Hudson, you know, economically was a depressed area for a long time, like a lot of the old river cities. So people weren't coming in and tearing down buildings or completely changing buildings. They just stayed the same way, the way they were. And now they're kind of reaping the benefit of that. You know, things weren't changed too much over the years. So now people are saying, wow, look at all this wonderful architecture. It wasn't because it was preserved for a reason. It was because, you know, economically there was no reason to change any of that. If you go to Prague, they've got the original architecture, one, because it wasn't bombed in World War II, but the communists were there for many years. The communists don't take down a beautiful old building and put up a shopping mall because they don't have a shopping mall. So now the beautiful building is still there to enjoy, kind of inadvertently. So I see that, you know, as something that's also happened in Hudson.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I learned a lot, and I enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming.